Good afternoon. Welcome to the 11:30 a.m. service here at ARPC at Adam. If you are new with us, we are doing a series on the book of Proverbs. And for this Sunday, for this week, we will be looking at Proverbs on the tongue, Proverbs regarding speech. There's a sermon outline inserted in your bulletin, and you might want to use it to follow the sermon if you need to. Now, have you ever wondered why snakes have tongues that are split? Right? Split tongues. Tongues that are shaped like a dessert fork. Not only that, have you ever wondered why snakes, they keep sticking their tongues out? You know, as they move, they keep sticking their tongues out. Well, the answer is that unlike our tongues, snakes do not have taste buds on their tongues. Unlike our tongues, their tongues cannot tell sweet from bitter, salty from sour. And unlike us, snakes use their tongues to smell. So each time the snake sticks out its tongue, the two tips, left and right, they work as a scent detector in full stereo, left and right, and enabling the snake to smell in two directions. So the split tip of the tongue captures scent particles from the air or from the ground. And whenever it pulls back its tongue back to its mouth, it is processing information to the brain. And so a snake is trying to decide whether to crawl to the left or right for food. What it does is that it sticks its tongue out. And the tip of the tongue collects some data. The left tip gathers the scent of a prey that went left. And the right tip gathers the scent of the prey that went right. And once the information is processed in the brain, the snake then decides which trail to take and locate the prey, following the invisible trails of scents left by the passing animals. Not only is a tongue used to smell for prey and have it for dinner, it is also used to detect any predator that is nearby and avoid becoming the predator's dinner. So that is the tongue of the snake. It's split, it's forked, amazing design. Now, thankfully, we do not smell using our tongues, right? Otherwise, it will be a little bit strange for us to be sticking out our tongues every time food is served. Or each time we are sampling a bottle of perfume, right? Sticking up your tongue to smell the perfume. But our tongues, apart from enabling us to taste food, does a lot of powerful stuff. Said to be the strongest muscle of the body, for its small size, the tongue is a very hard worker. And it works nonstop. Technically nonstop. Your tongue works, for instance, when you eat, right? It helps in the mixing process of food. Sometimes your tongue works as a toothpick and a toothbrush. When you are asleep, your tongue is constantly pushing saliva down your throat so that you won't choke in your sleep. And last but not the least, your tongue works for you to speak. It twists and bends itself to form sounds and produce spoken words. These spoken words form phrases or sentences and produce speech. Powerful tongues we have indeed. Now, why do our tongues utter words? Why are we creatures who speak? Why do we communicate in spoken languages? We speak, my friends, because we are created in the image of God, the God who speaks. The God who speaks. So animals who are created after their own kind, they cannot communicate in spoken languages. Your poodle, for instance, barks, but that's about it. Doesn't communicate in languages. Your Persian cat purrs and meows, but that's about it. Your parrot speaks, but really, it actually mimics only, right? It mimics you. They do not speak with you. It's only we who are created in God's image. It's only we who can communicate with one another through the use of our tongues, uttering spoken language. We speak because the God that we worship speaks. Idols, on the other hand, man-made gods, they do not speak. So Jeremiah, the prophet Jeremiah in Jeremiah chapter 10, slide comes up, compares idols with a scarecrow in a melon patch. Scarecrow in a melon patch. These idols, they do not speak. They must be carried because they cannot walk. But God, my friends, speaks. And one often repeated phrase in Genesis chapter 1 were the words, "And God said." And God said. He spoke the words and creation unfolds. Genesis chapter 1 does not simply tell us that God made, that God created. Rather, there is an emphasis in the spoken words of God. We see the creative power of God's spoken word. And so my first point, words are potent. They're powerful. God spoke, we see, and there was light. He spoke and there were sea creatures and sky creatures. He spoke and the land produced animals. God's words are powerful. God's words deliver. And when he finally created man, the epitome of his creation, God created man to speak. He's empowered to speak. And when man speaks, he utters words that carry power. And so we see from Genesis that whatever the man names an animal, that is its name. You know, the animal cannot protest and say, "No, I don't like to be called a hippopotamus." No, whatever the man gives, that is going to be its name. And when God gave Adam his suitable helper, he called her woman, and he named her Eve. Words, friends, are not without power. Words are potent. But words do not function as merely commands showing power. We see in Genesis that when God spoke, it was not limited to commands. When God spoke, he spoke to both man and woman. He did not do that, notice, with animals. God did not have a conversation with animals. Neither did God speak to plants. So for us who like to speak to plants, talk to our pets, please notice, God did not speak with them. It is only we who are created in the image of God. It is only we whom God spoke with. God blessed first man and woman. He spoke to them. He told them, "Be fruitful, increase in numbers, rule over the creatures. I give you seed-bearing plant for food. I give you fruits for your food." So we see that God speaks. And our makeup as God's image bearers is that we speak just as our God, just as our Creator speaks. What happens then when God speaks? Next point. Words give life. Words give life. When God speaks, his words give life. God's words sustain life. In fact, this is echoed in Proverbs and the purpose for which Proverbs was given to us. So Proverbs tell us, for instance, they are given to us to attain the paths of life, 2:19. They are the way to life, 6:23. They are given so that your days will be many and your years will be added to your life, 9:11. The wisdom of the Lord will be life for you, 3:22. And that the very goal of Proverbs, which is to lead us to the fear of the Lord, the very goal of Proverbs, it tells us that the fear of the Lord adds length to life, but the years of the wicked are cut short. Proverbs 10:27. If God's words are directed to give life, we who are empowered to speak must speak words that move towards the life that God intended. So consider Proverbs 15:7. The lips of the wise spread knowledge. Proverbs 10:21, the lips of the righteous nourish many. So our words must entice people to taste and see that the Lord is good. That our conversations must be filled with thanksgiving and praise to God who has saved us in Christ Jesus. And so whenever a brother, a sister falls into sin, that also means that we must need to be bold to speak words of loving rebuke and turn the sinner from the error of his way and thus save him from death and bring him to life. Sad that oftentimes than not, many of us chicken out, right? Chicken out from chiding a brother or a sister. we get tongue-tied, afraid to exercise the ministry of rebuke and restoration. But friends, we are called to teach, we are called to admonish one another as Christ's words dwell in us. So if God's words give life, we who are empowered to speak, we must speak words that move toward life as God intended. If God's words give life, it must mean too that we must speak words that uplift. We must speak words that invigorate. We must speak words that energize. So I challenge you to try this experiment. You know, when you're about to check out the items in your grocery basket, choose the lane that is the longest. Okay, don't go hunting for the shortest line. Choose the lane that has the longest line. Choose the counter girl who is not smiling at all. Why? Because she's been standing there for hours, in bad need of a break. And so when your turn is up, what do you do is do this experiment. Greet the cashier. Take a look at her name tag. Call her by name. Say something like, "Thank you, Cynthia, for serving me. It's a long line today, right? Long queue, right?" And I can assure you, I can guarantee you, you will bring a smile to that person's face. I've done that several times. Words are powerful. I know what it means. Why? Because when I was in college, I was working part-time for McDonald's. And Sunday is a day when we drag ourselves to work. Why? There's always a long line of impatient, hungry customers, and that can wear you down. But if there's just one customer who tells you after being served, "Hey, that was fast, thank you," it brings a smile to your face. And it leads me to tell my manager, "Can I do overtime work, just 1 hour? You know, so pocket more money," right? Words are powerful. Words give life. Words give life also because words heal. Consider Proverbs 15, verse 4. "The tongue that brings healing is a tree of life." Now, we may have heard phrases like "the elixir of life" or "the fountain of youth." It reveals to us man's longing to find the potion, to find the drink that allows him to live a good life, uninterrupted and unaffected by troubles, pain, and sickness. Well, the Bible calls it the tree of life. The tree of life. Where do you find the tree of life? There it was, in the Garden of Eden. It's the tree that is life-giving. It gives life. Where you have the tree of life, there is uninterrupted fellowship with God. Where you have the tree of life, there is no pain. There are no hurts. There's no anger. There's no bitterness. Nothing whatsoever that leads to death. Nothing whatsoever that leads to physical death, relationship death, lifelessness. That is why the tongue that brings healing is compared to a tree of life. So whenever we use our tongues to speak words that encourage, speak words that bring hope, speak words that assure forgiveness, they make life so wonderful, don't they? Jesus, who is the epitome of wisdom, spoke words that heal, not words that crush. And so remember when the thief on the cross pleaded and told Jesus, "Jesus, remember me when you come into your kingdom." What was Jesus' reply? Jesus said, "Seriously?" No, that was not what Jesus said. Jesus didn't say, "You even had the audacity to ask?" No. But Jesus' words were words of healing. He told the thief, "I tell you the truth, today you will be with me in paradise." The loveliest phrase that one could ever hear in his death, on his deathbed. And when a group of men brought before Jesus a woman who was caught in adultery, the Lord did not humiliate the woman further. He did not probe and ask more questions. He spoke instead words of healing. He said, "Neither do I condemn you," after the men have left. "Go now and leave your life of sin." Words are powerful. They give life. They heal. They are a tree of life. But words that have power to give life, sadly, possess also the power to give death. The tongue has the power of life and death, Proverbs tells us, and those who love it will eat its fruit. So words, they snuff out, they give death. So in Genesis chapter 3, we see that there is another character who spoke in the garden, right? It's a devil. The devil who clothed himself as the serpent. So the devil spoke to the woman, spoke to the man. By the way, if only Adam and Eve found it odd that a serpent could speak, that should have set their alarm bells ringing, right? The serpent spoke to them and led them to distrust God, led them to rebel against him and stage a mutiny by eating what is forbidden. Did God really say that you must not eat? Those are words that cause doubt. You will surely not die. Words that deceive. God knows that when you eat of it, you will be like God. Those are words that slander, suggesting that God is keeping back a secret to the detriment of the first man and the first woman. And so when the first man and woman chose to listen and trust the words of a serpent instead of clinging on to the words of God, they ate the fruit, and that led to death. The tongue has the power of life and death, and those who love it will eat its fruit. So sin came into the world, and death came also into the world through sin, Romans chapter 5 tells us. The result is that not one part of us is not affected by sin. How our tongues have since become either tied or twisted. We do not speak against evil, tongue-tied. We do not champion God's truth. We do not speak words that give life. Instead, our tongues are inclined to speak out our twisted minds. We now tap on the power of words to serve self, to serve sin, and to serve Satan. So we utter reckless words. We lie. We deceive. We slander, we gossip, we tear down one another. I do not know if you've watched the movie The Joy Luck Club. It's not a very old movie, just a few years ago. It's a movie about four Chinese mothers who have migrated to America, brought up their daughters with constant clash between Chinese and American culture. And one such daughter was Waverly. Waverly, who learned to play chess at a very young age. When she beat a Caucasian boy in a chess tournament, her mother was so proud of Waverly that she took her to the streets of Chinatown to parade her. Apparently, Waverly appeared on the front cover of a magazine. So there was the mother walking on the streets of Chinatown, holding the magazine, meeting fellow Chinese and telling everybody about her daughter who won the chess tournament. And so, feeling very embarrassed, Waverly asked her mother to stop, you know, boasting and flaunting. Now, in traditional Chinese families, children are not supposed to tell their parents what to do. No way. Mother reprimanded daughter, but Waverly fought back, and she fought back with a threat. And what was that threat? That she would never play chess again. So she threw away her chess set. But the mother did not budge. The mother did not scold her. Neither was there any mention of chess for the next few months. And so after some time, Waverly, intending to please the mother, said, "Mom, guess what? I decided to play chess again." How did the mother respond? The mother said this, "You think it is so easy. One day quit, next day play. Everything for you is this way. So smart, so easy, so fast, not so easy anymore." So Waverly, who is narrating in the movie, told us what she said was like a curse. It was like a curse. This power I had, this belief in myself, I could actually feel it draining away. I could feel myself becoming ordinary. And so all the secrets that I once saw in every chess moves, I couldn't see them anymore. All I could see were my mistakes, my weaknesses. The best part of me just disappeared. Why? Because she remembered mom saying, "You think it is so easy? Not so easy anymore." So even later on in life, when Waverly was seeing somebody, she was worried if mom would like Rich, her boyfriend. And so Waverly told mom, you don't know the power that you have over me. One word, one look, and I am 4 years old again. That's the power of the tongue. It paralyzes. It traumatizes. Ask the student who still remembers her professor's lashing. Where were you when God was giving out brains? That kind of statement traumatizes. Student will always remember it. It paralyzes you. So if it didn't paralyze you, the student would have said, "I was behind you." Ask any boy whose mother calls him, or rather mocks him, "stupida." Every time he creates a blunder, makes a blunder, "stupida." And the boy will always remember that. Ask any girl whose boyfriend tells her girl, you know, the classic breakup line, which is, "It's not you, it's me." And the girl will always keep on thinking, what does he mean by "it's not you, it's me"? Such words can incapacitate. They instill fear. They can suck the life out of someone. Words are potent. They give life, but they also snuff out life. And so does that mean that we must start working on our speech? Yes, but that's not going to work. Why? Next point. Because our words are actually fueled by our hearts. So remember when we had Paul David Tripp speak to us a few years back, right? Paul Tripp suggested that whenever we offend people, when we said something that offended somebody and we realize it was offensive, then we go back and say, "Oh, I'm sorry, I did not mean what I had said." Paul Tripp suggests that we should have instead said, "I'm sorry, I said what I had meant." Why? Because our words, the words that we blurt out, are but just the outflow of what's been brewing in our hearts. You snap back at your husband today, not because of a mistake that he did, but because you were unhappy with him since last week. You speak rudely to a colleague because he has overtaken you in his promotion, and it churns in your heart. You fire an angry email back, not because you're having a bad day, but because you finally had it. It's a low-level bickering in your heart. It has just spotted the perfect opportunity for its fatal unleashing. And so you deploy words fueled by your heart. So Paul Tripp shared with us about his uncle. His uncle, after getting intoxicated with liquor, he started uttering foul and abusive language, obscene language. His mother decided to take Paul and his brother Ted, and they were younger, and told them, "Sons, remember, nothing comes out of the mouth of a drunk other than that wasn't there in the first place. Nothing comes out of the mouth of a drunk other than what that wasn't there in the first place. It has always been there." Alcohol did not cause his uncle to say those things. Intoxication merely provided the occasion. It loosened its lips, and so it is now able to say what's always been in his heart. I had my first colonoscopy a few years back. And when I went to see the surgeon for the review, I asked the doctor, I said, "Doc, I remember shouting, 'No, stop!' Tell me, was that a dream? Was that my dream? Or did it really happen?" So the doctor told me, "Oh, you are one tough guy. I had to sedate you more halfway because you were shouting." So when I left the clinic, I had morbid thoughts, you know, not because of the results. I had morbid thoughts asking myself, did I curse the doctor in my pain? And I shared my experience with Elder Yip, one of our doctors here, who was the one who referred me to this surgeon. "Hey, this is my pastor, you know, can you take a look at him?" So I asked Elder Yip, did you get any feedback from the doctor? And he told me, if I did, do you think I would have told you? How do you think your speech will be like when you are partially sedated? Will your words betray a wicked heart that needs to be redeemed? You know, sometimes one does not need to be partially sedated to reveal the inner thoughts of one's heart. Nowadays, just go to the online world, just go to the virtual space, and you can actually look into people's hearts. Psychologists have observed that people's behavior in the online world mismatch their behavior in the real world. Why? Because people somehow perceive that the online world requires less responsibility, causing less harm than the real world. And psychologists have called this the disinhibition effect. Disinhibition effect, which means being online and behind the screen causes individuals to be less cautious about their actions. And so on the online world, people are more willing to rant. People are more willing to whine online, but they would think twice in doing so in person. It is not uncommon to observe how ungodly and how mean Christians can be with their comments and with their posts online, but showing no trace of such behavior in person. So I remember one student who's quiet, shy, always smiling. In a chat group, however, he behaves differently. He is a totally different person. He criticizes a lot, swears a lot, nonstop, and even bullies other people. And so I DM'd him a message. This was many years back, before WhatsApp. And I said, Jervis, is anything wrong? Why are you speaking like that? You don't behave that way when we see each other. And you know what was his reply? He told me, you don't know me very well. You don't know me very well. So friends, the virtual world may be virtual, but it reveals the real you. It reveals the real you. The disinhibition effect provides an opportunity to speak one's heart out. And our hearts drive our speech. Our hearts fuel words that give life or words that lead to death. It was Jesus who said, slide comes up, Luke chapter 6, verse 45. The good man brings good things out of the good stored up in his heart, and the evil man brings evil things out of the evil stored up in his heart. For out of the overflow of his heart, his mouth speaks. So whatever we utter comes out of our hearts. And so what is wisdom's prescription? What does wisdom tell us? Here is wisdom's prescription. Next point. Wisdom does not prescribe tongue therapy. No, sir. Not tongue therapy. So I remember when we are young, the therapy or the treatment for foul language, it was what? It was to gargle with soap water. That was what mothers made their children do when they swore. But you and I know that gargling with detergent does not work. It didn't work for me and my brother in our experience. We just confined all the swearing when we were in school. And then we would sanitize our mouth once we come home. And it took a quarrel between the two of us at home, a very violent quarrel, to harvest all the swear words from our mouths, no holds barred, to the horror, of course, of our parents. Soap treatment does not work. It may only place limits. No foul language at home, but carry on in school because people think it's cool. Neither does it help learning how to say the right words. So some people say, oh, you just need how to say it properly. You just need to exercise tact, practice good communication techniques, or read some self-help books, or join How to Improve Your Service seminar. Books have always recommended a few phrases that they say will go a long, long way. The phrase says, please, thank you, and I'm sorry. Yes, those are helpful words, but they do not last. And they do not address the problems of the heart. Proverbs 26, 24 tells us, a malicious man disguises himself with his lips, but in his heart he harbors deceit. Proverbs 26, 24. And so that's why mothers tell their daughters, never trust a man who promises you the moon. Why? Because although the man can say nice things, this proverb tells us that a malicious man may disguise himself with sweet words, but in his heart there is deceit. There is deceit waiting to be harvested. So I once read the story of a man who went to a department store minutes after the store had just opened. It was early and he was the only customer, very early, only customer. And as he looked on the display of shavers, he wanted to buy a shaver for himself. He called upon a sales attendant. The sales attendant snapped at him and said, "Do you have a number? Do you have a number?" He said, "No, I don't. I'm the only customer." And the sales attendant said, "Can't attend to you unless you get a number." So the customer went to get a number, came back and handed number one to the salesman. Salesman responded and said, "Thank you. May I help you, please?" To which, of course, he said, "No," and walked away. The salesman said the right words, right? But his heart was far from right. What is wisdom's prescription? Prescription, not tongue therapy. That's not enough. That's not going to help. But heart surgery, a heart surgery. James chapter 4, verse 8. "Come near to God, and he will come near to you. Wash your hands, you sinners, and purify your hearts." It's a call to come to God to confess your sins. A call to come to God, wash your hands, wash your heart, and allow him to mold your hearts. See, what was the source of quarrels in James's congregation? It was the unsurrendered desires of the evil heart. See, the real problem is not the tongue, but it is the heart that needs yielding and submission to the rule of Jesus Christ. For a heart that is not yielded to Christ can only be a heart that is fully given to the self. My pride, my desires, my convenience, my agenda, my pleasures. And so whenever angry words are spoken, it is because my pride was attacked. Whenever angry words are spoken, it is because my convenience was taken away. When reckless words are spoken, it is because my pleasure is important and I want to enjoy my pleasure now at the expense of the other. Our hearts fuel our words, and so we need to surrender our hearts to the Lord for him to mold it, for him to create in us a pure heart, no longer conformed to the wisdom of the world, but renewing our minds with God's wisdom, so that we are no longer tongue-tied, no longer tongue-twisted, but offering our redeemed tongues to speak words that give life, not death, words that heal, not crush, words filled with grace, words that redeem. I'm currently reading a book entitled Better by Atul Gawande, one of my favorite doctor authors. Gawande is a doctor who wrote, who wrote to raise awareness about certain medical procedures or practices that needed to be diligently exercised, carried out, for one to be a better surgeon. That's why the book's title is Better. So from the chapter on washing hands, I learned the importance of hygiene and also of speech. And let me tell you why I learned something about speech. He writes, "In 1847, at the age of 28, the Viennese obstetrician Ignaz Semmelweis famously deduced that by not washing their hands consistently or well enough, doctors were themselves to blame for childbed fever. Childbed fever was the leading cause of maternal death in childbirth in the era before antibiotics and before the recognition that germs are actually the agents of infectious disease. So out of 3,000 mothers who delivered babies at the hospital where Semmelweis worked, 600 or more died every year. 600. It's a horrifying 20% maternal death rate. Whereas of mothers delivering at home, only 1% died. Semmelweis concluded that doctors themselves were carrying the disease between patients, and he mandated that every doctor and nurse on his ward scrub with a nail brush, wash with chlorine between patients. What happened was that the childbed fever death immediately fell down to 1%. Incontrovertible proof, it would seem, that he was right. Semmelweis's hypothesis that there was only one cause, that all that mattered was cleanliness, was a hypothesis that was very extreme at that time. It was largely ignored, it was rejected, it was even ridiculed. And he was dismissed later on from the hospital for political reasons. Semmelweis was outraged by the indifference of the medical profession and began writing openly and increasingly angry letters to prominent European obstetricians, at times denouncing them as irresponsible murderers. And so he wrote, for instance, to one professor, "You, her professor, Mr. Professor, have been a partner in this massacre." He wrote to one University of Vienna obstetrician who questioned his theory. To a colleague in Würzburg, he wrote, "Should you, her Hofrat, Mr. Hofrat, without having disproved my doctrine, continue to teach your pupils against it, I declare before God and the world that you are a murderer." It was said that Semmelweis would stand next to the sink and berate anyone who forgot to scrub his or her hands. So that's why doctors and nurses begin to avoid him. Semmelweis was a genius, but he was a lunatic, and that made him a failed genius. His sharp words, his angry speech did not work for what he was advocating. So Gawande, the author, writes, "It would take another 20 years when a man by the name of Joseph Lister would offer his clearer, more persuasive, and more respectful plea for the need and the importance of antisepsis in surgery." So I did some reading on Joseph Lister. Joseph Lister, whose namesake is the gargle Listerine. Yeah. Those of you who are smiling are using Listerine. I found out that Lister, who is the pioneer, considered a pioneer of antiseptic surgery, was a committed Christian. He was a committed Christian. So the New World Encyclopedia describes Lister as a gentle, shy, unassuming man, firm in his purpose because he humbly believed himself to be directed by God. Lister was a gentle and humble man. Perhaps that's the reason why his thesis on antisepsis was accepted even by those who had earlier mocked his findings. Consider Proverbs 25:15. "Through patience, a ruler can be persuaded, and a gentle tongue can break a bone." 25:15. "Through patience, a ruler can be persuaded, and a gentle tongue can break a bone." Lister's respectful, gentle plea for antisepsis brought down the number of post-operative infections. It prevented a lot of post-surgery deaths. Speech filled with grace, spoken with gentleness, friends. Such speech redeems and gives life. And so in closing, the tongue has the power of life. It also possesses the power of death. But Jesus came to rescue us from sin and death. And so when we offer our lives to follow Him, we offer our all to Him and for His work. We offer our tongues to speak words that snatch others from death, lead them to life in Jesus. We season our conversations with salt, fill it with grace, we answer kindly, and we turn away from deceitful speech. We turn away from lies. We turn away from slander, from unwholesome talk, keeping our tongues from evil and our lips from speaking lies. May the Lord enable us, empower us to use our tongues always to His glory for the good of our fellow. Allow me to pray for us.